Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
There we are.
Here we are.
Yeah, I think there we are is the end, isn't it?
I mean, we could try and get in the record books for the shortest episode of a podcast ever.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I want to give a shout out to some football fans. So I was on the train back from Doncaster, and a bunch of football fans got on at Stevenage, and they turned out to be Cheltenham Town fans.
Aha. Uh-huh. When a bunch of football fans get on the train, I never think, oh, this is going to enhance my journey.
I think that's very nasty prejudice.
But it's happened to all of us. If you want a bit of peace and quiet, it doesn't fill your heart with joy when a bunch of football fans... Maybe it does with you.
Well, they're coming off the back of a sort of emotional experience.
Which I find only adds to the volume levels. They don't respect the quiet coach. You're not biting on this, are you?
I'm not. I wasn't in the quiet coach. Cheltenham Town had just unfortunately been relegated, which was sad, I think from League One. Rather hilariously, they then said to me at the end, "Hey, do you want to buy a football club?" And then, "Have you got your Euro coaching B certificate?" I think they were either wanting me to own the club or manage the club.
Wow. I think, firstly, they're overestimating your affluence.
Yeah.
Secondly, I mean, that could be, you've talked about a hobby before now. Maybe doing your coaching certificate could be a thing.
I don't think I never really very good at football, and I think particularly my younger son would say that. So, I was thinking, because I went to see Arsenal-Chelsea with Sam earlier this week, and they won 5-0, and I don't want to sound too sort of cliched, but there's two interesting things. One is the sort of sense of community of supporting a football club, but secondly, the sort of massive range of experiences. Cheltenham Town is like an average attendance of 3,000, and I said to one of them, "Do you have a season ticket?" And they were like, "It doesn't really work like that. At Cheltenham Town, you can go when you want."
That's nice, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
But you don't have to plan these things in advance.
Now, talking of sport.
Yes. This is great. This is a story from The Guardian yesterday. Beetroot and beefless bourguignon. I never like saying a French word in front of you because I feel you're very judgmental about the fact that I didn't really pay attention in GCSE French.
Well, you know, I'm much more in the doo-doo than you here. I've had two parents who both spoke French, and I, you know, I'm sort of in the je m'appelle Edouard sort of situation.
Oh, but you went and taught at the Sorbonne that time, didn't you?
In English. It was Sciences Po, and it was in English, matey.
Anyway, beetroot and beefless bourguignon as Paris Olympics embraces vegetarian cuisine. So this is such a surprising story. As part of its efforts to cut...
Why is it surprising?
Because the stereotype of France perhaps the least of... vegetarian of all the countries.
I'm with you, sorry.
Although as a veggie, I've had mixed experiences there. I would say Spain is the worst for me, but that could be because I don't like an egg. Anyway, as part of its efforts to cut carbon emissions, the Paris Olympics will make history by offering more vegetarian cuisine than in any games.
I mean, I don't know how they measure that, really. Keep going. I keep interrupting you.
No, please do. It'll boast the world's biggest salad bar. Do you enjoy a salad bar?
It's a complicated question, sir.
I have a friend who we used to go to Pizza Land, and they would allow you one trip to the salad bar. And what he used to do is increase the circumference of his bowl by layering cucumber.
Keep going with this story, though.
Okay. It'll boast the world's biggest salad bar, offer fans vegetarian hot dogs, and bring in up to 500,000 bananas by boat to meet athletes' insatiable demand for the fruit whilst avoiding the carbon footprint of air travel. I also read that passion fruit is banned because there's no way of bringing it in a low-carbon way. France is the European country with the highest beef and veal consumption per inhabitant, but chefs say the Olympic Games will rebrand French gastronomy as a showcase for plant-based food. So, you know, they have a restaurant in the athletes' village, the Olympic Village.
Yeah,
it serves 40,000 meals a day.
Wow.
It's open for 24 hours. It's the biggest restaurant on Earth for its duration.
There's a bigger one on Mars.
One third.
I mean, in the world, I think is what they mean. On Earth, that sounds slightly odd. If you go to Pluto, you can find a bigger restaurant.
I wonder if they've used the word world earlier in the article.
Maybe.
Have you ever seen that Twitter account, Second Mentions?
No.
It's just quoting examples of the journalism that has to find out. On Earth, a third of its 500 recipes will be vegetarian. Oh, and they're going to be eating off washable plates for the first time instead of disposable ones.
I'm interested in the vegan escalope sandwich.
Yes, that's...
What is that?
I don't know, but it seems very French to think.
So it's normally a veal escalope, yeah?
Yes.
So what is the sort of slab of...
I know that they are partnering with one of these meat substitute companies, so it might be one of those. But don't you think it's the most French thing in the world to think, what would a vegetarian want to eat? An escalope. How do we make that vegetarian?
Well, but don't you think this takes us to Maureen Smith?
An email.
Yes,
absolutely, because you made yourself a veggie lasagna the other week.
Yeah. So Maureen Smith writes in, subject veggie lasagna, hi, real lasagna disaster from a few weeks back. Can I endorse Jeff's recommendation not to bother with meat imitations? Go straight for meat-free when wished. There is a wonderful vegetable lasagna on BBC Good Food, which needs more peppers than listed, and I add double, and I added diced courgettes as well.
Sometimes there's an odd texture thing that can go on with a courgette. I think it can go either way.
Courgettes are also pretty disobliging about you too, actually.
Should we also mention that Maureen says, also re-London foxes and tortoise keeping? My son lives in Brixton and has had to rescue tortoises which were dropped in his garden by foxes. Sadly, not all survived, but a poster campaign reunited one with its owner. Wow. You've had quite a lot of adventures and misadventures and encounters with foxes, but to date, there's been no terrapins, tortoises, turtles, anything like that.
No, I can't report any of those.
So I thought, inspired by this story of the Paris Olympics, where have you found to be the worst and best places to be vegetarian or vegan? So I've been to India a couple of times, and it is vegetarian paradise. I don't know how you'd fare as a vegan, because they use ghee and paneer quite a lot, and yogurt for that matter. And then France, I have had really good vegetarian food, some of the best meals of my life in France. But I do remember once going to a restaurant near Nice and saying, so what do you have for vegetarian? I don't eat meat or fish. And the waiter says, we have a goose liver soup. And I kind of looked at him and held his gaze and said, trying to work through the logic, how on earth does he think that is vegetarian? I said, does that not have goose liver in it? And he shrugged in a very French way and said, yes, but it is in a soup. And that must be 20 years ago. And I'm still unable to unpack the logic of that.
The world has changed. Now, I would like, as we're about to, because I think Maureen is kind of understands where I'm coming from, good vegetarian recipes.
Great.
I'd like good and simple.
The email address is chat@cheerfulpodcast.com.
Now, should we talk about smartphones?
Yes.
So, The Guardian has a piece, The Boring Phone, Stressed Out Gen Z Ditch Smartphones for Dumb Phones. The Boring Phone is a new featureless flip phone that is feeding the growing appetites of young people who want to bin their smartphones in favour of a dumb phone. The latest model caused a storm when it was unveiled this month at Milan Design Week and is part of a new dumb phone boom. Built on the suspicion of Gen Z towards the data and attention harvesting technologies they've grown up with. This suspicion has fueled reinventions of retro cultural artifacts, a trend known as Neutro.
Neutro.
And seen the arrival of vinyl records, cassettes, fanzines, 8-bit video games, old-fashioned mobile phones, and the game Manic Miner. Actually, I added that bit in.
That would fit in with Neutro, though, wouldn't it? A ZX Spectrum revival.
And then there's also an article in the Boston Globe, interestingly, and this refers to some Norwegian research which tested how would student outcomes and mental health be affected if schools banned smartphones. And the research found the impacts were positive, including decreased bullying and improved academic performance amongst girls. Now, this was raised by Justine with the Young Gamelibands yesterday. The Guardian article, not the Norwegian thing.
So do they have phones?
One of them does and one of them doesn't.
Uh-huh.
There was much eye-rolling.
So they're not part of the Milan Fashion Week hipsters who are banning the smartphones in favour of dumb phones then? Can you not try and convince them that it's trendy?
Maybe. I just...
Don't use the word trendy, though. I don't think that plays
the trouble
well
is, can I just say, isn't there a kind of do-as-I-say, not-as-I-do problem? In other words, if we abandoned our smartphones in favour of a dumb phone, which I must say I would be sort of open to, then that would be easier. I have thought about doing this, but I think one thing about these dumb phones is they might be becoming smarter in the sense that they do have, like, navigation apps and so on them.
See,
I didn't really look at social media on my phone.
So then what are you looking at? What's distracting you?
Well, I suppose the interweb.
But what, you're Googling things?
Like reading the newspaper or whatever, you know.
So when you say that you have thought about getting rid of the smartphone, what is your behaviour that you think you need to change?
That's a good question. I suppose I'm not really in that category, am I?
No, so are you just getting carried away with the anti-smartphone?
But you know, I have this thing where I go on holiday and I don't take my phone. I tend not to take my phone on holiday and I leave it and I have sort of diversion. I do find that is really much more, I feel much more relaxed.
But aren't you always on Justine's phone when you do that?
Yes, but it's less, it's much less reflexive, check the phone thing.
I've got really mixed feelings on this because the Norway thing is interesting.
And also it's like, it's getting you where you kind of are vulnerable, which is Scandinavian.
Yeah, so I'm very open to any research from Scandinavia, yeah.
You basically don't like all this stuff, do you? Let's just be honest about this.
So mixed feelings. I'd love somebody to give me the counter, but I don't see a good reason for people having phones in school.
Yeah.
And I've been to, I don't know, premieres and shows and things where they've got little lockers that your phones can go in until you come out, and surely there'd be some version of that they could do in schools if there's safety concern.
I think that my kid's school doesn't like kids to have their phones out.
But maybe there is.
But I think one thing that's interesting about the Norway research, I haven't looked at the original research, but this account of it is suggesting that even though obviously these young people would have their phones outside school, there is an impact on bullying, etc., by not having them out in school. Did you see what I mean?
Yes, so bullying went down. Maybe there's an anonymity that people could assume when cyberbullying, so that would explain why that goes down. More generally, I think there is a lot of hysteria about phones. I really like my phone and I really like how I use it. And I wouldn't say that was the case 5 years ago. I've changed my behaviour on there so that I'm looking at stuff that isn't triggering for my mental health. I think when phones are accused of being too addictive and rewiring our brains, I think there's some responsibility on on the part of the manufacturers and the app
developers. Definitely.
But I think that it's also the underlying things that are causing you to become addicted to an online behaviour are perhaps more interesting.
But can I go for something very specific, which is when you and I were at school, you got home and you were, unless you chose to engage with your peers, you were sort of, you weren't about to be bullied or, you know, or whatever. Now that's, you know, some of what my kids do on their phones, on the phone, you know, is actually nice engagement with their friends and so on. But there is something much more stressful about that, isn't there?
I think you're right. I think you're right. And I'm not saying there's no responsibility there. But isn't it a bit like blaming a fist for punching someone?
Well, isn't that a bit like saying, when America says, you know, guns don't kill people, people kill people. That's like, yeah, but the availability of guns makes it more likely you're going to have terrible shootings.
Yes, I've joined the NRA. I feel really humiliated to have made I feel really humiliated to have made that point. But I think this is what I say. I think there's a balance. And I think almost all of the conversation is about the technology. And very little of it is about where that behaviour is coming from in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I think that somebody was saying to me recently the company should have a lot more responsibility. You can't make this a responsibility of...
I think that's right, but I'm always really suspicious of any tendency of people our age to say, my child never did me any harm or things were better when I was a kid. I saw a thing online the other day where some celebrity was campaigning for kids to practice physical handwriting more than typing out more because it's more natural and it encourages a meditative state. Now, I think there are really good reasons why handwriting is important, not least of all motor skills. But I also think that screens and the ability to type probably opens things up in different ways for kids who are maybe, say dyslexic or have ADHD.
I'm sure that's right.
Yeah, so I'd like a little
some amazing things on apps and so on. So, you know, the amazing access to the world that you get. I mean, I that's why I think it is complicated.
What would your life look like without animal videos, Ed? You'd be a sadder man.
I don't watch that many animal videos.
Oh, you should. Yeah. They're great.
Maybe I need to watch more animal videos.
You go through your phases, don't you?
Yeah, only if they happen. I happen up because I don't spend time on Twitter or Facebook. I have to see them on sort of mainstream
media.
Yeah, well, there you go.
You're the one person who's getting his animal videos from mainstream media.
Exactly.
We'd love to know what you think about this. Have you binged your smartphone? Probably not if you listen to a podcast, because that tends to be how people listen to them. But maybe you've gone to an 80-20 dumb phone smartphone split. And also, if you wanted to stick up for the smartphone, it'd be interesting to hear from you too. The email address is chat@cheerfulpodcast.com.
Now, talking of technology.
Yes.
This is Bloomberg Green.
Mm.
Meet the Home Energy Nerds by Olivia Rudgard. On a windy, sunny day, the UK grid is over 70% renewables. On a grey, still day, the picture looks quite different.
I didn't know it was that high. Yeah. 70% renewables.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Homeowners with solar panels can make their own electricity. Those with a battery can store it for future use. Now, basically then talks about people monitoring their electricity use and so on. Just ask home energy nerds, people who have become acutely aware of their relationship with the energy system. They know exactly how many kilowatt hours their electric kettle uses, the precise time of day to charge their EV. Since January, I've been using, this is the author, a gadget from a UK company called VoltaWare to track energy use in my home. The startup's app shows me my electricity footprint and breaks down by individual appliance.
Wow.
Now, I think this is something very interesting. And I think we're sort of in the foothills of this. I went to a company called Give Energy, which is a battery manufacturer, recently. And the costs of batteries have really come down. And there is something incredibly transformative about a battery in your home because what it means is you, particularly if combined with a heat pump, because what it means is that you basically draw down power when it's cheap, because when the wind's blowing, et cetera, and when other people aren't, there isn't big demand. And then you don't draw power when it's most expensive. And the interesting thing about that is it reduces demands on the national grid, obviously, because you're not drawing it at peak times from the national grid. And it also means you've got a much cheaper bill. And I think we're in the foothills of what this decentralized energy can do for people. And I think, in a sense, the big challenge, if Labour is in government, is how we make sure that this is done in a way that doesn't just help the middle-class people who can afford these gizmos, but can help people across the board. And I'm quite focused on thinking about this. But I think it is, interesting. The smart meter is obviously key to this, and the smart meter situation is not great. There are 4 million faulty smart meters in the UK.
Oh, really?
Which haven't been mended.
My dad was obsessed with his for a while. He hid the toaster when he figured out how much electricity it was using. He locked it in a cupboard.
But there is something really interesting about this. You know, it's sort of like the way you think about the way people have thought about the power system in the past is big. You build big kit, the big kit supplies the power. And obviously you're going to need the big kit and you need the grid and all of that. And that's going to have to be expanded. But there is something very interesting and empowering here for people, which is you're going to control much more of your own energy needs and when you use it. And also there's something called time of day tariffs coming. Some companies offer this already, but you will get, it will be cheaper to run the electricity at non-peak times.
Oh, like how you used to wait till after 6 o'clock
Economy
to make
7.
A phone call.
Was it called Economy 7? Do you remember when we were growing up?
Yeah.
Now, some companies already offer it, but it's not sort of washed through the whole system in a proper way.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because I am someone who's very confused by all the tariffs and the deals and when you have to change. You know, I just let that stuff slide. And these energy nerds, it sounds like they're gamifying it. So there's something about this app, talking about smartphones being addictive.
Yeah.
Where they're becoming addicted to efficiency, if you like, to saving money and monitoring appliances, sort of gamifying it. And then presumably the next step is somebody's going to write an algorithm that will do this stuff for you.
There are companies now doing that.
Uh-huh.
So you don't, it's not like you don't have to like do it. It gets done for you.
That's not how I'm going to make my million.
I think probably not.
Yeah, I mean, I can't write algorithms, so that would have been a detail.
Honestly, it's the make your own sandwich shop. That's the answer.
I'll tell you what, I would love to hear from a real life energy nerd. Are you one? If so, let us know what you are doing to hack your energy bills. Are you getting the ironing board out in the middle of the night? Are you dropping everything no matter what you're doing when your app gives you a notification saying now would be a good time to power hose? The email address is chat@cheerfulpodcast.com.
Now, can I ask you about this New York Times article about MidTV?
Yeah, so Ed sent me an article from the New York Times. It's called The Comfortable Problem of MidTV. And the subheadline is it's got a great cast, it looks cinematic, and it's fine, and it's everywhere. And it's talking about the sort of drama and to some extent comedy that you see on the streamers, anything from Apple TV, Netflix, and so on, that it's typically very expensive looking. It has big Hollywood names in it, but it's ultimately not that great. And I tell you what I thought was so interesting about this article is the way that we have changed to expect television to be great.
Oh, what you mean? Because we had three channels and it was Bullseye, then it was sort of
exactly. So the bar has been set very high by things like the Sopranos or Succession or The Wire. But these things only come along, I don't know, you know, once or twice a decade. And I'm sure it was true before that with stuff like Boys from the Black stuff or Our Friends of the North or whatever. And then what we watched was largely filler. So, I mean, I don't mean to disparage Bullseye, but Bullseye, lots of game shows, things like property shows, location, all this stuff. We weren't expecting it to be that great. We were expecting it to fill time. But because drama in particular is now paralleling or sometimes surpassing what they do in films, then we expect it to be that good, and it often isn't.
Yeah.
Because people romanticise the
past. I mean, there's much more of it, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, yeah, which in theory should make it better.
Or there could be sort of long-tail reasons for this, couldn't there? Which, in other words, it's just, it's sort of, it's kind of catering to different markets.
Also, 20 years ago, it was very rare to see a Hollywood star. It was a real...
Yeah.
You don't go back...
You wouldn't have got Harrison Ford in Shrinking.
No, absolutely not. In fact, when George Peppard did the A-Team, because he'd been this movie star, because he'd been in Breakfast at Tiffany's, it was seen as a real... come down, and he only did it because he had such a terrible reputation for being difficult to work with. But, you know, there was a lot of stigma involved in stars going from film to TV.
The thing that keeps sort of rolling through my mind is the conversation we had a few weeks ago about the final episode of Seinfeld versus the final episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which I know are not comparable, but the fact that Seinfeld got 73 million viewers and its final episode, it was only 20 years ago. Well, 20 and a bit years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder what the highest, presumably that was the highest rated, apart from the Super Bowl, American TV program that year. I wonder what the highest rated, apart from the Super Bowl, program is.
Yeah, you see the American TV ratings now, and they look unimpressive, even if they were in the UK and in a much, much smaller country, like a quarter the size or whatever.
Just got so interesting this. So I've just got up the from Variety, the most watched primetime telecasts of 2023. The top 30 are all American football games.
Wow.
Right? And that goes down to 15 million. But the first drama is the OT. Do you know what the OT is?
Is it about an occupational therapist?
Isn't it like a bit like Beverly Hills 90210 or something?
Well, that's the OC I think you're thinking of.
Oh, sorry. hang on. Oh, no, it's a sports thing. Sorry. Okay. Uh-huh. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, so not the OT. Accused, Series 1, Episode 1, Scott's Story on Fox. That's 10 million. NCIS Hawaii, right. Series 2, Episode 10, Deepfake, 10 million. So that's the answer to my question, isn't it?
Yes, but these are viewing figures that would have been normal for EastEnders 20 years ago in the UK.
I know, that's what's extraordinary about it. Yeah. They're down to 10 million when Seinfeld got 73 million.
It's a funny one, isn't it? Because people are watching more video than ever before because we're spending more time with screens than ever before. Did you see that, you know, the post office thing, Mr. Bates versus the post office on ITV?
It lost £1 million.
Yeah, and that is the most talked about drama I know. British TV this year. But unless you can sell something internationally, it's very difficult to make money out of TV programmes.
Now, this is all a roundabout way of me saying we've got to the end of the second series of Slow Horses and we wanted to give ourselves a break.
It's so good, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but what would you recommend?
I'll tell you what podcast I really loved was the thing called The Curse with Emma Stone and Nathan Fielder, which is unlike anything I've seen on TV. It's about a couple of youngish, wealthy property developers who are trying to make an impoverished community a property hotspot.
Right.
But seemingly, because they've been filmed for a documentary whilst avoiding the
pitfalls of gentrification. I started watching some of it and it wasn't... You know, we are difficult.
You've got more difficult as you get older as well.
Oh, thank you. anyway, look, if you've got any recommendations, let me know.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with Host Red sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book Host Red sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Now, should we do some correspondence?
Yes, this is from Anjali Gaines, subject St. George's Day. Hi, Ed and Jeff. I listened to your excellent episode with Mark Steers and Tom Baldwin on my morning run in Leicester on St. George's Day.
Ah, fantastic.
It prompted me to think about not only how curious it is that we don't celebrate our national day, but about holidays in general. My mum is originally from Nepal, where there are about 40
amazing
public holidays per
amazing.
Year.
That sounds like your kind of place, Jeff.
It really does. It says, whereas in England we only have 8, which I believe is one of the fewest in Europe.
Yeah.
She says, I was also reflecting on how bland our bank holidays are, with no traditions attached to any, except for the Christian Easter and Christmas celebrations. Even the days themselves are boring names, like early May bank holiday or summer bank holiday. We could take a cue from Martin Luther King Day in the States and rename a day to reflect a great modern Britain. Keep up the chatteroo.
I mean, the May Day bank holiday was a workers' day, wasn't it?
Didn't Thatcher change it? Because it was International Workers' Day, May Day in other parts of Europe. I was reading that in France, like it's the one day of year that McDonald's is closed.
Really?
Yeah. But yes, was it Mrs. Thatcher who changed that?
I don't know.
I've got that in my head. But
do you think it's fake news or real news?
Maybe fake news.
I mean, you know that whole thing about how Mrs. Thatcher was supposed to have said anyone who travelled on a bus is a failure, and it turned out to be fake news. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. And then there was another thing recently where some Conservative MP, did you see this, was speaking, I don't know if it was at a fundraising dinner or something, and quoted a story about Mrs. Thatcher, and then it turned out to be a spitting image sketch.
Yeah, you see, you've got to be so careful, don't you?
Well, thanks for emailing in, Anjali, and it'd be good to get some suggestions for renaming bank holidays. Let us know what you think. Also, if you've encountered any particularly interesting public holidays elsewhere in the world, let us know about those too. The email address is chat@cheerfulpodcast.com.
Now, this is from Anthony Brown, England, according to the big-nosed bard of Barking. Great to hear Mark and Tom on the pod. Ed's office was a real incubator. Oh, that's nice. Did either of you ever read Billy Bragg's book, The Progressive Patriot? He writes, quote, we need to challenge the right's monopoly on patriotism, not by proclaiming our blind loyalty to our country right or wrong, but by developing a narrative which explains how we all came to be here together in this place. I think this is a really important point and resonates with what Tom and Mark were saying. We English can be too enamoured with our history and not our ongoing story. If we want to foster an inclusive sense of English identity, we need to convey that the recent past, the present and the future all as just as worthy of their chapters as Shakespeare or the Second World War. I'd also recommend Billy's excellent song, England Half English, a multicultural celebration in the style of Ian Jury.
Do you remember that song?
Which is Anthony Brown's Salisbury. I do.
My breakfast was half English, and so am I, you know. I had toast and Marmite soldiers washed down with a cappuccino. I may be mangling that, but
Is there a cappuccino in that?
I think there's cappuccino, yeah. It's a fun song.
Right.
That book, I did read it at the time. It was... It's interesting that we're still having those conversations nearly 20 years later, isn't it? I also remember Billy Bragg around the same time, I guess. He had a song called Take Down the Union Jack, which was about reclaiming the St. George flag for England.
Oh.
And it came out to coincide with, I don't know, one of the Queen's Jubilees or something. And Billy enlisted me and my then radio co-host in a campaign to get it to number one the week of the Queen's Jubilee.
And did it work?
I think it got to like number 82 or something. So the moral of the story is, if you want a number one, I'm not your man, really.
Oh, I think you're my number one.
Thank you. Oh, on the subject of music, I have a tiny little quiz for you to finish this. Why have you turned on these quizzes? You used to enjoy them, and now you pull a face as soon as I say the word quiz.
Well, I think it's going to be embarrassment and humiliation. That's the thing.
But you did very well on the last one.
I'm worried I'm going to get like something like half out of 7, which will be really embarrassing. Which is what you got on the quiz.
Oh, of course, yeah. Yes. Must you bring that up?
Yes.
So I wanted to know: have you listened to the new Taylor Swift album yet?
Yes.
What do you think?
I really like it.
It's called Tortured Poets Department.
Yeah.
And there are 31 songs on it.
Yes.
And I know you're a fan, so I've made you a little quiz. It's called Swift or Swift.
Yes.
And I'm going to give you a fact, and you have to tell me about if it's about Taylor Swift.
Oh, I love these. I do like these, yeah.
Okay, so is this about Taylor Swift or is it about the bird, the Swift?
Yeah.
All right. Fact number one. Mm. Flies up to 178,000 miles in a single year.
The bird.
No, it's Taylor Swift. Have you not seen that? There's a 21-year-old college student in Florida who has been tracking private jets owned by
her. That's really clever. Okay.
Thank you. Has tiny feet.
Well, what does that mean?
Either Taylor Swift or the swift, the bird, but has tiny feet.
That's a sort of vague. That's a very vague.
Okay, has much smaller than average feet for their species.
Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift.
No, she's a size 7, which is pretty average, as it turns out. Whereas Swift the bird has tiny feet and almost no legs, which are adaptations to their aerial lifestyles. Likes to consume likes to consume beetles.
Yeah, the bird.
No, it's Taylor Swift. Paul McCartney is one of her biggest influences. So, you know,
no, that's ridiculous. She doesn't consume beetles.
Of course you do, but you consume it when you're enjoying the art of something.
That's ridiculous. I want to recount. Yeah.
Okay. Famous for screaming parties.
Was screaming parties?
Yeah, like a party that's screaming. Screaming parties.
Okay, the bird.
Yes, they band together in screaming parties, which are tightly packed formations to a dozen swifts that speed madly around trees and rooftops to the sound of their instantly recognisable calls.
That's a clever question, yeah.
Okay. Declining presence in the UK.
Well, that's obviously the bird.
No, it's Taylor Swift. There's a song on her new album, as you all know, called Leaving London. She used to spend a lot of time here because she was courting various British men. So... sorry, that was that just one out of five there?
Yeah, at least it was. At least it wasn't a sort of zero.
No.
I was quite lucky. That was a very clever quiz.
Thank you. All right then, I'll just remind you of the things we'd like you to email about.
Not me, the listeners.
Yes, I mean you can as well if you want.
Yes.
Firstly, do you know an energy nerd? Or are you an energy nerd? If so, give us some energy hacks. Did you hear that story and think, oh, here's what I do? We also were after worst and best places in the world to be vegetarian and vegan. Ed wants some veggie recipes. Have you tried to bin your smartphone, or have you downgraded to a dumb phone, as they're calling them? Would you like to offer a defense of the smartphone?
Yeah.
And then suggestions for renaming bank holidays.
Yeah.
Also, if you've got any quirky holidays from around the world or any quirky public holiday traditions from around the world, those would be great too. The email address is chat@cheerfulpodcast.com.
And hopefully we have Will Hutton and his book next week. This time, No Mistakes.
Have a lovely week, Ed.
Have a lovely week, Jeff.
Bye.
Bye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.